أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والحمد والثناء لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين حبيب قلوبنا والشفيع ذنوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيت الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين ولعنة الله على أعدائهم أجمعين من الآن إلى قيام يوم الدين رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقه قولي. And that salawat really gave me a little bit of energy, especially since I've been traveling for about 24 hours to get here. And I needed that energy right about now. There's a hadith that talks about the Prophet when he went to Mi'raj. For those of us, sometimes when we say a lot of salawats, we get lazy. Our tongue gets lazy, and the next salawats, they come out and they sound like we're murmuring something. But doesn't hardly do justice to the praise of the Prophet that we follow. But when the Prophet went to Mi'raj, he saw one of the things that was introduced to him was an angel whose sole job was to count raindrops. So this angel knew exactly how many raindrops fell in the barren land, how many raindrops fell in the sea, how many in the jungle, which country. He could account for every single raindrop and every place that it fell. That was his sole job. And he told the Prophet that there's one thing that he cannot count. He said he cannot count the blessings of giving salawat upon Muhammad or Ali Muhammad. We're talking about the dignity, respect of the mu'mineen. And some of the important points were already touched on. And I want to also reiterate some of these very, very important things that we need to understand. You know, a lot of times when we talk about dignity, when we talk about respect, today we have a different concept of what gives people respect. What earns respect? What makes a person deserve dignity in our eyes or in the eyes of a lot of people today? Someone dresses a certain way, oh well, I like the way that person dresses, so I respect them. A person has a certain amount of wealth, so I like that this person is like this, so then we respect them for that reason. Or someone, for what all kinds of reasons that we have, their race, their heritage, all of these different things, we find a reason to respect people sometimes, and vice versa, also disrespect sometimes. But the question is, are these the reasons that we should respect people? Is this the value system that we should have? In the Quran, it talks about the verse that you all know so well in Surah Hujarat, where Allah is speaking to all of mankind. And He says, "Inna khalaqnakum min dhakarin wa untha." I created you from a single male and female, all of you. Wa ja'alnakum shu'uban wa qabaila. Despite that all of you have this one single origin, now you get dispersed. And not that you get dispersed just randomly. Allah's work is calculated. He says, Ja'alnakum, we placed you and made you into different tribes and nations. Lata'arafu, so that you may know one another or have an identity. But even despite you being so different in so many ways, with different languages and different colors and different backgrounds, he says, what's important to Allah? Akramakum indallah atqakum. As the one who has the most piety. This is the only thing that Allah is valuing. There's a tradition from the Prophet where he tells people, those who are even sayyids, who have this special connection and blood attachment to the Holy Prophet, he says, don't be happy just because you're related to me. Don't make that be enough for you. You need to earn and have taqwa. You need to gain your respect in Allah's eyes. You know, one of the major issues that we have always is the cultural differences that exist amongst us, especially amongst Muslims, because Muslims are some of the most diverse, have some of the most diverse backgrounds of all people. And rightfully so. It's not like when people say, for example, a lot of times when they say Jewish, they mean not necessarily all people or all ethnicities, all backgrounds. That's not usually what's being included. But someone can be Muslim, they can be from anywhere. They can have any background. They can be any race, any color. So they have this common thread which unites them, and that is that Islam. Salawat. What happens, I want to talk a little bit about cultural or community development and how the role of the Prophet and what he intended. When the message of Islam came, the Prophet intended to obviously spread this message of Allah all throughout the world. It was the saving message for all of humanity, everyone that exists. Now, in the process of doing that, and sharing Islam, many people from many backgrounds obviously came to Islam. And this was one of the things that broke down barriers and united people. So people who, when they would not associate from someone because they were from another tribe, or they would not, let alone associating from someone from another place, another country, just a different tribe. We're not talking to you, we don't have anything to do with you, we look down upon you. And the Prophet came and he broke those barriers. The A'imma came and they broke those barriers. Their closest companions were people like Bilal and Salman, people who were not normally amongst the Arabs, maybe they would have looked down upon these people. Or people who were slaves. Some of the people who were in the in Karbala were people who were slaves, like Joan, for example. People who came in the battlefield, he was the person who would sharpen the weapons and take care of all the weapons. And he was a person who served Imam Ali. He was a slave who was freed, and he served Imam Ali, he served Imam Hassan, he served alongside Imam Hussein, and he became Shaheed in Karbala. But this didn't matter to them, this background or what color he was. It mattered to them what was his taqwa, his piety. This is the only thing and this common thread which unites us and can bring us together. So sometimes when we get away from the way that the Prophet did things, we mess up, you know, essentially. That's what happens. If we once someone told Imam Khomeini that with the revolution that he was conducting in Iran, that you're going to take Iran so many years backwards because of this revolution. Now you're going to make us go back, you know, hundreds of years by doing this. We were getting so advanced, we were doing so good, we were progressing and getting along with all the Western states, and now you're going to send us back by doing this revolution about Islam. Imam Khomeini told him, I want to go 1400 years back. Back to when things were the way the Prophet Muhammad did things. When things were the way they should be. We can't look at compromising our values as an advancement for us socially. We can look at that as an option. Our success is in doing things the way that Allah sees it successful, the way that He intended. So when we get away from that, then we get problems. So we see that how society and communities were developing during the era of the Prophet. And then we see that what has happened in this day and age. And it's very interesting how we see some of the major differences. Like I said it before, sometimes we bring our baggage to Islam, right? We're going on a trip to Islam land, but we have a lot of baggage. We need to pay for all that baggage. It's costing us a lot. Islam is suffering because of that, because of all the extra things that we bring to Islam. Islam says to do things one way. We say, well, we want to add this spice to it and that flavor to it, and we want to change it so much that it's no longer what that thing that Islam had intended, what Allah had intended. Now, when it comes to things like, for example, the idea of differences in culture, I don't want to give the impression that there's something bad about culture. Very much the opposite. In fact, what Imam Sadiq explains about the coming of the Prophet, what he explains is that the Prophet came to show people what things in their culture were not a part of Islam. So they had this pool of all these things that they would do. This is all cultural baggage, right? This is this big duffel bag of cultural baggage. So these things they took out, oh, these things don't belong, these are not part of Islam. The rest of it, if you want to do, you keep it, no problem. So this is where the difference is. Culture is not the problem. The problem is anything which goes against the way that Islam intended. So Allah sets guidelines for us. And when we go against those guidelines, that's when we incur problems. You know, for a lot of communities, let's look at, reflect on Islam in America. I would say probably for a lot of you who have been here, you probably know, when I was growing up at least, when I was a kid, and we were growing up, obviously, I'm from Philadelphia, and that's a city where there's not really a lot of followers of Ahlul Bayt, although there are a lot of Muslims. And so because of that, we would travel to other cities that are nearby to participate in some programs for Muharram, for example. We would a lot of times go to New Jersey, maybe go down to D.C., maybe go up to New York, places that are not too far away that were holding programs and different activities and such. One of the places that we used to go to for a very long time at that time, and I want to show you how the change and the transition and how Islam has changed in America. At that time, we would go to a place when there were no programs in English. And growing up as a little kid, we would still go to these programs, we would participate, do matzim, everything. I learned a lot of Urdu at that time, I guess. And but it wasn't anything that was thought that it was a need or a necessity to have these programs in English. So 15, 20 years later, when I go to that community and I'm speaking in that community sometimes, what I'm witnessing is the transition and the change in the community. If there's a lack of vision by the people who establish the community, the organizers, then they may suffer. In their vision, they were not thinking that we need to spread Islam necessarily. We just need to have a little piece of back home so that we don't, you know, we could still relate to having some kind of program, something we can understand. But the vision was not we need to spread Islam or everyone needs to be able to be a part of this or participate. So because they didn't plan for that future, then what happens is now there is a generation of young people, and a lot of the youth who are growing up here today who are identifying with this culture in America and identifying with, at least, like I said, the cultural, the things that don't have any conflict with Islam, and are growing up here, which is, there's nothing wrong with that. But then there has to be a message that's put in their language. There's a very common, simple concept that they say, that they mention about in psychology. Speak in the language of the listener. You want to talk to a little kid? You don't give him big philosophical words and start talking about the metaphysics and the philosophy and how things are contradicting and so on and so forth. He's going to say, what are you talking about? Buy me ice cream. You talk in his language and what he understands, he's going to say, now that I can understand. I can connect to that. And so if our goal is to share that message and to continue that development that the Prophet started, then we have to use the best means and methods to do that. Now, like I said, when some centers, because of their lack of vision and they did not plan for this, then they have this cultural gap in their centers where there's little kids, then there's no teenagers, and then there's a lot of older youth. And this is happening, and the reason why I mention it is not particular to a particular center or this particular center. It's something that's more like an epidemic, and it's happening a lot of places in this country. One of the basic things we can do is plan better and be more mindful of the future. You know, if a lot of places, for example, they, when they want to have an organization, when they want to have a board and a group of people and some volunteers and community members, maybe a resident alum or, and all of these things which make, you know, a center, then sometimes what they don't think about a lot of times is planning for what the center is going to be like the next 10 and 20 years. Plan about what this, what programs we're going to have for the next year, what programs we're going to have for the next month. But planning ahead of time, this will solve a lot of the problems. I want to share with you how important developing our communities is, looking at it from a different perspective. They have a concept in philosophy, they say if you want to understand something, understand it from its opposites. Understand black from white, light from dark. Let's understand things from the enemy's perspective. Those who are against Islam, look at it from their point of view and see how they are viewing your cultural or your community development as Muslims and what they think about how you're developing or what's going on. Now, it's no secret that this Islam has a lot of enemies. It's no secret that these people have been against Islam and they do all kinds of different things and different tactics to defame Islam. Everyone knows that. CNN is number one culprit, right? We can't go and watch any kind of media and get honest representation. We know that. We know that there's some agenda behind the way that things are explained, the words that are used, the word association and word games, Muslim terrorists. We know, we've caught on to all these tricks. But I want to bring your attention to one thing, and that is that since you look at how Islam has been growing in this country, right, when you know that it's the fastest growing religion. Now look at it from an enemy's perspective. This is the fastest growing religion. Now obviously if I can do something to stop it, I will. But apparently that's not working because, as Sheikh mentioned, despite the lack of our efforts, Islam is still spreading. So something, by the blessing and grace of Allah, by the honor of our Prophet, Islam is still thriving. Maybe we have some work ourselves to do to be more actively a part of that. But beside the point. Now, if I'm looking at it again from an enemy's perspective, and I see that despite my efforts, Islam is still growing. What do you do when there's a virus that you cannot contain? You try to quarantine it. You try to contain it. You say, you know what? At least I'm going to try to stop it from spreading. I can't destroy the virus. Well, I'll just put it in this little box and I'll make sure that it stays there. So how are they going to do that? Well, they don't have to do that, brothers and sisters. We do that for them. This is the bad news. How do we do that for them? Well, if we want to make sure that Islam doesn't spread and doesn't continue on in the next generation in this country, then I make sure that this establishment that I created does not understand or represent the culture and the people who live here. I make sure that it's a box that nobody can come into. So if at that time, when we were young and we were going to these programs, and they were, for example, in Urdu, we had a little bit different perspective. My parents were looking at it from a different outlook. They loved Islam, and it didn't matter to them. They would sit in an hour, 2 hour long sessions with matam and everything in a language that they didn't understand, simply because of love of the Ahlul Bayt. But the majority of the people are not like this. And the majority of the people are not going to come to that, to get that message, or they will not be able to benefit as much. So if we do what the enemies are watching and saying, let me see if they're going to do that. Okay, they got the center, they're building it, they're putting everything together, but they're going to make it in such a way, for example, all the programs are only going to be in Arabic. So nobody who's non-Arabic is going to benefit. You don't know Arabic? Too bad for you. I'm going to make everything, and everything is going to be cultural, it's going to be all Iranian, it's going to be Nowruz 24/7. And nobody who doesn't know anything about Persian culture, you're not going to get any benefit. So, when this is practically happening today, and you can look all over this country and see it, then guess what? We have done them a favor, and we have quarantined ourselves. We have made ourselves in such a way that we're not able to progress in the way that Islam was intended. So this is something that we have to be very careful of and give you more from the enemy's perspective, more from the Tawhut's perspective. There is, I heard from the mouth of someone who was an FBI agent, administrator, he said, someone asked him, why do you send people into our masajid and centers and things like that? And usually, you know, they get very, they have this vague memory about things like that, and they'll deny, or they can't recall, or they don't know anything about these type of things. But that wasn't the case. He said, yeah, we do that. Sure, we have to do that. We're protecting you. So to hear it from the horse's mouth, so to speak, what it means is that, and what the job of these people is more important. The role of someone who would like to infiltrate an Islamic establishment is to make sure that this quarantine remains as such. It's to make sure that if this place is, you know, divided, that it remains that way. If this place is not associating with the other Muslims, it remains that way. There's strength in numbers. You think they don't know that? But if I can keep you a few numbers, and you a few numbers, and you over there a few numbers, and I make sure that your differences are such that no matter how small they may be, they seem significant to you to the point where you may not even give salams to another Muslim. To that extent, then I have succeeded in my goal despite being the fastest growing religion. This is something to think about. This is something for us as members or leaders of communities to be aware of, that we never fall into that fold or that trap, that manhole that's been set before us to keep us from progressing and moving forward. There is a way to do that. There has to be some kind of transition phase. There has to be some kind of way where cultures, Islam is such that it adapts to everything. You know, one of the biggest problems that people have or misunderstandings about Islam sometimes is they think that Islam was a religion for 1400 years ago. Guess what? Islam is for every day and time, every moment, it adapts to every situation. It gives us the tools. It gives us the apparatus to be able to derive rulings, to be able to adapt to every problem in society. When there were horses then, or whether it's cars now, whether it's cyber crime, stem cell research, or whatever the thing is, Islam has a viewpoint on all of these things. We have to understand how we get those things. So Islam is going to have the solutions and the answers for everything. Islam has an answer for our community development. We have to be able to look and realize that the same way Islam adapts to all times, it adapts to all cultures. And that's where you may find that we do things differently. And different cultures may represent different ideas. That's one person, they shake hands a little bit this way, another person, they shake hands a little bit that way. They have these subtle differences amongst different Muslims, and that's not the problem. The problem is if these subtle differences become magnificent in our minds, and we are not able to work together, we are not able to build communities. unity, community. This is the goal, and this is what the Prophet intended. When he tells those tribes that you all carry a piece of this, and you all walk together, just the basic things involving people. See how he united tribes with something so simple. We unite people like that. We give importance to them. I give importance to someone else, even if they're from a little bit over that community or vice versa. Now, I do want to make one distinction. And that is that sometimes there is a possibility that people can be outside of the boundaries and guidelines of being able to work with them. Yes, if someone is going to be a Muawiyah, for example, a Yazid, and in the name of Islam do things, and yes, obviously that's somebody who we can't really work with them. It's going to be very difficult. It will be up to leaders with political savvy, with good insight, to be able to know how to deal with these type of people. To know when you need revolution or when you must, when you have to, like Imam Hassan's situation, have a peace treaty. Not because he agrees with Muawiyah, not because he's saying that these things are okay, but he has the insight and understanding of the situation to know what's best. But generally speaking, there's such a wide spectrum of people and what they believe in ideology-wise, what they follow, and if they're not too outside of these boundaries, then we need to be more mindful about our ways that we can deal with them and work together. I mean, look at the examples of Imam Ali. Look at the examples of the Prophet. The Prophet was given knowledge of everything from Adam to Qiyamah. Do you think he doesn't know about a munafiq or two or three or four or anyone else? Do you think that he doesn't see or doesn't realize? But how does he deal? How does he work with? So the strategies and the methods are things that we have to be concerned about, and at the same time realizing that actively there is opposition. Actively, there are people waiting for the downfall, and more importantly, in this case, they just want to keep it status quo, just keep it the way it is. We're not worried about if you, little group five people, are going to go do a protest. As long as you don't go with those other people, and you guys don't get together, and you're not making a lot of noise, then we start to get worried. This is the situation that we're looking at. And obviously for us, everything is about the perfect example and following that in Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Please say salawat. There is another thing that the enemies try to do in face of Islam, and it affects our community's developments. And that is, they want to change the way that we look at ourselves. They want to destroy the self, in essence. Destroy the worth of the self, of the human being. Now, if you look at, let's say, for example, America 50 years ago, you're not going to see people dressing up and wearing these kind of crazy outfits that some people are wearing now. You're going to see people looking a lot different. Even the way that people treated each other. Kids used to say yes sir and yes ma'am and things like that. People used to be so much more respectful. So something changed between that time and this time. Someone had a role in changing the way things were, even in this country right here. What changed is the value system. There's a time when a woman being fully dressed or wearing a long dress was considered respectable. You look at these old cartoons and all the princesses are wearing long dresses. There's something that they want to project this culture that was beautiful, that was okay and acceptable, that had value. modesty had value. But if I want to destroy these people, then I have to destroy their value system. So I remove modesty as a human, as a value that they have, and I replace it with immodesty. And now I tell them, that's cool. You know, that's really hot. When you're immodest and you change that perspective of people. Now, a fully clothed and dressed person, oh my goodness, this sister is so oppressed. And a less dressed person say, oh no, that she's so liberated. Right? You see how the value system has changed? And if you work on people over the course of time, and they themselves, they destroy the self by changing their own value system. Now where are they at? Now they have accepted a totally different value system that doesn't have any value. What is it based on? It's not based on the morals, any divine morals. It's not based on these laws of religion. It's not based on what we have in our hearts as even human beings, in our fitrah, in our essence. These are not things that are wholesome. You know, it's like, for example, I tell you that, hey, I'm going to give you these magic beans and they have value. Okay, you give me the gold coins and I'll give you the magic beans and you take these and they have value for you. And you say, hey, okay, these have value now. I change completely the value that you see in things, then it distorts the way that you look at things. And you're going to go to the car lot and tell the Mercedes-Benz leaser that you have lots of magic beans to buy with. Because I changed your perception completely and made you think that something which doesn't have value actually has value. So this is a part of a very well calculated plan to change the way that people feel about things. Things that are anti-Islamic, we give them value. So then you find some people, for example, again, like I mentioned, some women who will look at hijab and say that, oh my goodness, this is so oppressive. But look, when people look in their fitrah and their essence, this is something that we can't deny inside ourselves, any human being, the way that we are created as a human being. If we remove religion even from the equation, there are certain things that as a human being, each and every individual will understand. For example, if taking the life of someone who's innocent. If there were no religions existed, just hypothetically speaking, everyone would understand that there's something wrong with that. The same way, we all understand in our bottom of our hearts certain things that are wrong. This is immoral. This is not right. It just reminds me of what the Italian Prime Minister said about when they were talking about the hijab ban in Italy. And he said, how can I sign on for a hijab ban when every image of Hazrat Maryam is shown with her wearing hijab? He says, how can I approve of that? Well, that was part of a value system in Christianity which has been changed. So we have to be mindful that we do not allow our values to be compromised. So this whole incident of trying to defame the messenger of God and trying to make a mockery of Islam, this is an effort in this same plan to defame Islam and this same plan to change the value of Muslims or how Muslims are viewed. But this is all, brothers and sisters, I'm here to tell you that it's all part of a much bigger plan. And the worst is yet to come. But it's a test. You know, one of the ulama said they want to test the waters. See, let me see what happens if we do this. We defame the Prophet. Let's see what happens and what kind of response we're going to get from these Muslims. Okay, there's a lot of protests. Maybe we still need to work on them a little bit. There is some hope for us, inshallah. Salawat. It says the Prophet is Uswatun Hasana. He's the perfect exemplar. His actions, his deeds, everything about him is perfection. So when they're constantly trying to destroy the self, we are constantly trying to build the self. Self-building and self-improvement is all about this. That we're constantly in the heat of battle. This great jihad or this great battle, this great struggle that we're fighting about maintaining our own morals in face of when society is telling us that that's actually immoral. We're fighting and struggling for this every day. So that maybe, just maybe we can be called the Shia of Ali, the Shia of Imam Mahdi, Ajjalallahu Farajahu Sharif. There was one of the companions of Imam Sadiq. He went to this authority figure. He sent one of his close companions, Imam Sadiq sent one of his close companions to this authority figure to take a message. And this person, he was upset. He didn't like these people who came, these companions who came from Imam Sadiq, and he told them, he said in a derogatory and negative way, you Shias of Ali, you Shias of Imam Sadiq, they said, please don't give us that title. They said, we're not even worthy to be called the Shia of Ali. This is one of the great companions and close companions of the Imam. He said, don't even call me that. I'm flattered by you thinking that I'm worthy to be called one of the followers of Imam Ali. But in hopes that we are somehow close in that category of the followers of Imam Ali, it would only be because of the self-building and the spirituality that we've done and working on ourselves. Yes, I'm talking about community in the greater sense, but community starts with each and every individual. It's a football team, it's a family, it's a basketball team, it's a group of people working together. You put a group of team of athletes and they're working together and one of them or two of them or three of them are not doing their job, then that team is going to fail. They're going to lose miserably. They won't make the playoffs. But you put together that team where everyone is working on themselves. They're after hours, they're at the gym, they're working out. Each individual is saying, I got to get better. I have to get better. How often do we hear that? That is the Shia of Imam Ali. No, it's so easy for us what we do. We have one of those big fingers that they use at the games. You know, they have the fans have those massive glove fingers, and we're pointing the finger at people all the time. Oh, this person didn't do that. Oh, that center, they did that. Oh, look at brother so-and-so. So we're so good at this. We can point the finger a mile away at everybody and find faults and problems. When can we point the finger at ourselves? When can we look in the mirror and say that I need to work on myself? I'm not following the Prophet and what he stood for, who he was. Yes, it is true. Imam Ali even says you can't be like me specifically, but you always have to strive to achieve, to be as close and near and possible, to emulate them as much as possible. That is the quality of the Shia of Ali. So we work on the self and constantly building ourself. It's unfortunate, and the Imam, when he receives reports of our actions, it says that he weeps. The Imam that we love, he's weeping. Why? Because our actions don't reflect those who call themselves the true followers of the Imam. Our actions have to reflect that. Mere verbal reciting a dua or saying that I am a Shia of the Imam or a follower, that's not enough. That doesn't get the job done. Or just having it in our hearts that we love the imam. No, that doesn't get the job done. In fact, I will tell you that there are places that human beings can reach only with the love of the Ahlul Bayt. There are places in spirituality that you cannot even dream about reaching without the love of the Ahlul Bayt in your heart. And this love is something so powerful. It may be the only thing that is the intercession for us on the last day or in this world. So it's a condition for those who call themselves the followers that they have to have this love in their heart. It has to be real. It has to manifest into action. You ask any person who's married, can they have the love for their spouse in their heart? They better manifest into some flowers or some nice gifts or some good akhlaq or something. But if I just say that I have it and I don't do the actions, it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't have the value. In fact, that is the method of those who are the hypocrites. They do something different. They're not the true followers. And we want to be followers of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Salawat. So coming to a close, there is a way that we can be that's such that we infect everyone around us. Now, there was a scholar who he came in the, I believe it was maybe the 1940s, 1950s. He came from, I believe it was Bangladesh or Sri Lanka. And this scholar, he came here and he gathered a group of people. And he started to teach them things. Now, this group of people that he gathered, they lived way out in the suburbs somewhere. They were very well off, wealthy. I mean, it was around the 60s and 70s. So these are a lot of hippies. And he started to teach them things, how to eat, etiquette. Etiquette to spend a part of your day reflecting on the actions that you did. Muhasaba. Teach them that people have rights. Haqqun nas. He started to teach them all of these things over the course of years and years and years. These people, after so long, after such a period of time passed, he said to them, do you like to teach the things that I've been teaching you? They said, we love this spirituality, this new age spirituality that you're teaching us. He said, this is just Islam. So now this community, who are all, who are majority, were Caucasian, Jewish hippies, they are all Muslim now. And he taught them without actually even first telling them that this is Islam. You know, you don't need an Islam stick to teach people. Tap, tap, tap. Islam says that you should do this. No, you can teach them in the most subtle of ways. Invite people to Islam, the Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, بِغَيْرِ أَلْسِنَتِكُمْ without using your tongues, the tongues that we like to use to chit-chat and talk a lot. He says, invite people without even saying anything, with your kind heart, with your kind gesture. It's the most subtle of things. When the Prophet, peace be upon him, goes to see that this same woman who dislikes him so much, when he goes to see one day, there's not trash in my way, let me see what's happened. Are you okay? Is your health fine? Say, but I've been treating you badly. So this is Islam that tells me that I should treat you like this. Well, that action is what changes the hearts of people. You always hear about Muslims complaining about the perception of non-Muslims have about Islam. Do something about it, please. Stop complaining about it and just do something about it. Show in your actions, in your place of work, at your place of business, and where you go to school, show in your actions something that will make somebody feel that a Muslim has value. Show with your actions. Don't give them a long speech like I'm giving to you. Show them with your actions. They speak much louder than words, obviously. This is why we find people like Imam Shafi, who from the Shafi madhab, and you read his poetry, you wonder, did he love the Ahlul Bayt that much? He says that that term that they use, that they call the followers of Ali, Rafidi, that term, if that means that loving the Ahlul Bayt means that I'm a Rafidi, he says then that means that I am the most Rafidi of all. Because I love the Ahlul Bayt so much. Why? It's because of their actions. Is it because of a speech that they gave? No. Is it because of what they stood for? The actions that they did, how they treated other people, despite how they may have been treated. Finally, the last point that I want to make in thinking about, again, the scope of community, and how one part of that is working on myself. Now, what that means is that I don't use and take advantage or misuse the blessings or the blessed prophet and his teachings to be a means to do wrong. I'll give you an example. You find people nowadays turning Islam into Christianity in the sense that the same way that many Christians have gotten this idea that, well, I can do whatever I want during the week as long as I go to church on Sunday. Or I can do whatever I want throughout my life because Jesus died for my sins. So actually they're taking Hazrat Isa alayhi salam and his magnificence and they're putting it under their feet and destroying the value that it has by making it a means to do wrong. Not saying that even if we hypothetically accepted this concept, which we don't, but even if we did, and we said that because of this, then this means that Christians, they believe that Jesus died for their sins. Then why would you make that something that you can show how blasphemous you are, how disrespectful you can be by doing more wrong things, by doing more misdeeds? But guess what? Muslims are doing the same thing. You know who they are, Muharram Muslims. They show up every year. Some of us may be them. What do? Whatever we want, all through the year. Come Ashura time, I remember that hadith that says, if I can get this one tear out, Jannah is promised for me. I'm going to get this tear out. I want to beat myself till I can't walk. Why? Because this is my way of taking advantage or trying to misuse a concept. I'm trying to muse Imam Hussein. I'm disrespecting his movement and his sacrifice by trying to make him a means for me to do wrong and to commit sin. Just because when people commit sin, there's a justification process that goes along with that. You know, because they don't feel good about it, at least not in the beginning or the first times, and they have to say, well, some kind of thing they put in their mind. For example, when people do wrong, they'll say other people do this too. Or they'll say that, well, it's just a little bit. Or they'll say it's just one time. And they'll find a way to justify the wrong that they're doing. Through this justification process, it makes them more bold to be able to go do wrong. So they use the same method when it comes to Imam Hussein and say that, well, because of this, because of what Imam Hussein stood for, and by crying and weeping for him, all of the thawab and blessings that have been mentioned, that I'm going to do whatever I want, but I'm going to make sure that I cry during those nights of Muharram. These are not the Shia of Imam Hussein, the Shia of Imam Ali. These are not the Shia that they're talking about. In fact, this is damaging the religion. Like I said, enemies sit back. Oh, as long as you're going to do that, we're fine. We don't have to make any plan to destroy you. Oh, you're going to do that, then that's okay with us. The same concept Muslims have in a broader sense when we're talking about just accepting Islam. Yes, I've accepted Islam. I believe in Allah. I believe in the Prophet. What about the actions that show that? You're saying you believe in the Prophet. Actions saying something else. It can't be both.